Man, it's been a while.
Yeah. Well, we had some guests, some travel.
Yep. It's good. Good
guests month. Are good. We're going to have more guests.
Can you believe it's Q2 already?
This is like...
halfway through Q2 already.
There's like a Twitter account. It's like year progress.
Yeah.
And every time you see it, you're just like, oof.
I know.
Oof.
I know. Q1 went by really fast this year.
Sorry, I'm not ignoring you. I'm trying to find...
Pull up the podcast topics.
Podcast topics, yeah.
Q1 went really fast.
It did.
The trainings always, and just Ember Comp, always kind of take up a lot of time. But it's great. It's just that it feels like there's not much room left in our brain space for any much else. You know, originally we had some plans to do like more Mirage stuff Q1, but we're really kind of kicking that off now. So that's been fun.
Yeah. It is too. Yeah. The trainings, Ember Comp, travel, just it fills that void of all the free time you have. And yeah.
Yeah. We've been talking a lot about, you know, like letting your yeses be yes. And if you ever say yes to something, making sure to follow through with it so that you understand the full cost of that commitment. And more importantly, you understand everything you're saying no to. And so that in the future, hopefully, when someone asks you to do something, you are making that analysis up front.
Yeah. But there's a nice saying, like behind every no, there's a deeper yes.
Yeah, yeah. So, from the power of a positive no.
Yeah. So really saying no. Also feeling comfortable saying no to everything, because I think that's like a hard, I think if you haven't stretched that muscle before, it's hard to do the first time. Like, you know, it's very easy to tell everyone yes and then just not follow through.
Yep.
Super easy.
Yes. Yes. Because there's never a moment in time where you have to confront that decision. Basically the fact that you've backed out. It just, the way it happens is over years of, expectations being not met.
But it's really bad.
It's really bad and erodes a lot of trust.
Yeah.
And you beat yourself up over it. So I agree with you. Like, I like the way you put it where it's like you're flexing a muscle, because the first time you do it, it feels bad. But then you're like, oh, if I ask people to do stuff and they tell me no and they have you never question it. You never.
They don't even need a reason. Someone can tell me no. I'm like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. That's all. Yeah. That's like, no is a complete sentence is another one I've heard.
Nice.
Isn't that good?
Yeah, that's really good.
You don't owe anyone a reason for saying no.
Yeah, because otherwise you get into like the no, but we could.
Or you feel guilty, or you like someone starts guilt tripping you or demanding a reason. And it's just to understand that, it's just like being in control of your time and your priorities and stuff.
Nice.
Yeah, no is a complete sentence. Yeah, saying yes, I'll do that. And I've been trying to pay attention to this like the last month or so, just the ways I'm like, oh yeah, let's get together. Like, or yeah, we'll definitely do that. Or yeah, that's a good idea. Like, let me try. I'll work on that soon. Like, I feel like all that stuff is the same category where it's just like, that's just not good. You know, it's like, it's better to go into it saying like, let's find out if there's a, it's kind of like the consulting thing too, where you don't want to go in and say, oh yeah, let's help. Let's get something going. It's like, you want to go in, starting with you have to prove to me that this is a good fit. You have to sell me this and make sure that I'm convinced that this is going to be something that's going to be mutually beneficial and we can actually be successful with, as opposed to going in and saying, oh yeah, we'll make your website. Sure.
That's so true. I just like the consulting thing is real, like hits really home, because I used to always say like, oh, I'd love to help or definitely. But then I started changing all my like, you know, initial contact things to like, let's chat. Let's see if there's a good fit.
Right.
Let's find a way, you know, but yeah.
It's just such a difference. Just that tone setter, just that little bit. Right. I think there's a book that Jonathan Stark recommended called Start With No. I haven't read it yet, but I think that's what the book is about. And it's just to understand that, yeah, you want to start with no, because you want to be protective of your time. You want to make sure you're convinced that there's a successful project before you embark on it, and before you get into six months of work that is a waste of time, either for you or the other person. So
yeah.
So yeah, we've been trying to like wrap up some of our open source stuff and kind of put a button on it and just figure out what's the next thing we want to work on, really focus on and do it right. You know, we've talked about like bug-free open source before, and whether it's like a technical bug or like docs being lacking, we consider that a bug. And so when working on new software, we like this idea of like committing to a very small set of functionality until you can ship it bug free. Again, both functionality wise and documentation wise. And so like we've been trying to do that with our projects, you know, get it to a point where we can just freeze on new features until there's the thing is bug free and then move forward. Cause I just feel like it's so easy to just hack on stuff and get ahead of yourself, you know?
Easy and fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like looking at it as like end to end polish, like thinking about it in those terms. I want good end to end. Can Ember install this and it just works.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. So what do we have on our list?
So these are, I've got a lot of topics.
Spilling tea on myself over here.
Nice.
Have I mentioned how much I hate tea? You know what I hate even more than tea? Filling a coffee cup up with coffee just to find out it's lukewarm.
Dude, iced coffee. You got to do iced coffee.
If you want to ruin my Friday, that's how you do it. Oh, on top of that, break the microwave so you can't heat it up and get your lukewarm coffee hot. So then you have a decision to make. Do I drink this cup of lukewarm coffee or do I throw it out and make tea? Those are both bad decisions. You don't want to find yourself in this situation.
The best part about this is you have the cup perfectly angled. So you're showing the WeWork logo to the camera. It's this podcast brought to you by WeWork.
It's their fault.
Okay, so I have a bunch of stuff I ran into the last few weeks. Like we can do like speed round through this stuff.
You've been Ember hacking, huh?
A lot of Ember. The first thing is just, we don't even need to talk about it. I mean, I'll just briefly talk about it.
Yeah.
LTS versions. I never really understood how they work. It sounds kind of stupid to say, but it's something I learned this last week. So my understanding of LTS was always, it's like every four versions. So it's like 3.4, 3.8,
yeah.
3.12.
Is that not true?
It's like kind of true, but not, you know, there's some rules around this. So 3.8 came out and I was like, okay, I need to update my add-ons to test against like this LTS version. And then like, I couldn't figure out if 3.8 was LTS. It said it was in some places and other places said it wasn't. So I asked for clarification and this makes a lot of sense that when 3.8 comes out, it's a regular release.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives them time to like release it, fix bugs, mm-hmm. get people using it. When 3.9 comes out, 3.8 turns into
an LTS. So that way it'll be like, it's really 3.8.4 or something.
Yeah,
exactly. The fourth patch release of 3.8 is the thing we're actually committing to supporting.
Exactly. And it makes sense because like the day that 3.8 comes out,
it's going to be unstable.
Yeah, exactly. It's only been out for a day. How can it be like, oh, it's safe to upgrade to.
Right.
So yeah, that was just a little.
So if you're the implication of this is if you're recommending a team like just go from one LTS to the next, they want to wait until the major version after the LTS comes out.
Right.
Oh, cool.
Right. And so like when people talk about 3.8, it often gets talked about as in like an LTS because it will become an LTS.
Right.
But like, you know, 3.9 just came out. So I guess 3.8 is an LTS right now. But like 3 weeks ago when I was doing all this work, it wasn't an LTS. So
I see.
So yes.
Cool.
You don't need to jump to the latest LTS. Wait a few versions.
Cool.
Wait to 3.9, 3.10.
Great to know.
Yeah.
Nice. Did you hit some instability in an earlier version of 3.8?
I was just unsure if like, should this be in my try scenario? There was like documentation that said it was an LTS. There was documentation that said it wasn't an LTS. I just didn't understand how that process worked. My thinking was it was just every four versions.
Right. Right. Yeah. Cool.
Test apps and why we need them.
Oh yeah. You ran into this.
I actually think this is a nice example that like kind of like simplifies the use case
for test apps.
Yeah. So in, Storefront, we use add-on docs. And then we have some animations in our documentation. So we're using Liquid Fire.
Mm-hmm.
Liquid Fire has a hard dependency on jQuery. It uses jQuery. That's like non-negotiable. You can't opt out of it. So someone opened a PR that said, hey, here's like a Storefront try scenario that tests Storefront against Ember Octane. And I was like, this is awesome.
Yeah.
This is awesome.
That is cool.
So I couldn't merge it because it was failing. And I went to look at why it was failing. And Ember Octane doesn't ship with jQuery. And so we're in this like weird spot where we need jQuery.
So really Liquid Fire doesn't bring along jQuery. It has like a peer dependency on jQuery. It expects the host app to provide jQuery.
Yeah, I think so, because this is from a day where every Ember app had jQuery.
Right.
Also too, it's like if you want to test that your app works in Octane, you need a brand new Octane app to test that against. If you're testing it against your dummy app that also uses Liquid Fire,
right?
That's not testing against Octane. That's testing against like an Octane app that happens to have Liquid Fire installed.
Right. Right.
And so this brings us to the topic of test apps.
Right.
So we really need individual apps that actually represent like what is a brand new Octane app look right. like? Because your dummy app, unfortunately, is just not what a brand new anything right. looks like. It has right. its own dependencies, right. its own dev dependencies.
That's the key. And you know, we've talked in the add-on docs channel about making the add-on docs site. You know, it's great that it uses a dummy site in the sense of it was great to get us all going, but now that add-on docs as a project has become more complex and has more dependencies, and it should be able to have whatever it wants to make it easy for us to build it and for people to add their doc sites.
I want animations in my docs.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But it shouldn't mean that you fail a test suite. You should be able to use angle bracket components in your doc site and not fail a test run on an older version of Ember, because you don't care about running your doc site against an older version of Ember. If you think about it, your doc site is only ever going to run against one version of Ember. There's one build of your doc site. It's an app.
Yep.
And it's an app. So in the same way, you wouldn't test your app against different versions of Ember. Really doesn't really make sense to test your dummy version. What you want to test is the functionality of your add-on against different versions of Ember. And so for that, it makes more sense to have an isolated environment where you're not doing all of the docs kind of things. So I think the long-term solution here is to move the doc site out of dummy and into like slash docs. And you can still run a test suite against it. You can still run tests against it. So you can still write an acceptance test against it, but it would just run it not in the different scenarios. For that, you would be running isolated tests that are in your like root test folder, or again, if you have a more complex scenario, a test app.
Yeah. I mean, I like what you're saying, but I still think you need test apps.
Comes a time where you need test apps because you didn't have
your add-on. Your add-on is going to have dev dependencies. And if your add-on has dev dependencies, therefore your dummy app is not
actually what
a brand new Octane app. Yeah. It is a Octane app plus these dev dependencies.
Yeah. The dummy app has problems that folks have talked about, and I know Ed in particular has said we need to make this basically a normal app and not this special version of an Ember app with like random dependencies that are implicit.
I know you and him both use test apps, right?
So if anyone runs into this and wants a way to do this, and also like this is especially helpful if you're writing an add-on that's intended to be consumed by other add-ons, and you want to see how like transitive usage of that across multiple add-ons works, you want to set that environment up. For example, an add-on that consumes Ember CI Tailwind and then is used by an app, what's the behavior there? You would need to set it up yourself. And so what I do is this is what you've been calling test apps, which is like I set up a scenario and I bootstrap those things myself and I just do them on disk. There's like this Fixtrify stuff that lets you kind of new up an Ember app or an add-on, and by representing the files system files as like JSON. So you could imagine like given these files on disk, but you're doing it in a test in a JavaScript object. So you'll see a lot of that in the Ember ecosystem, which is nice for like simple things just to save you from writing the files. But at the end of the day with the test apps, we just decided it's way better to have the full test app there on disk just because it's higher fidelity.
A huge benefit is you can actually CD into the test app and run Ember.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. If you look at Mirage or Tailwind, we have test apps there, so you can go and copy that. Now, originally I copied this thing from Ed, basically how he does it in, I think first was auto import, because you can imagine auto import wanting to have all sorts of scenarios to stress, including, you know, testing transitive dependencies. And he did this, and there's like this Perl script that he had that he caught from somewhere that runs like your test suite against all these test apps in parallel. And he has since moved to a monorepo, I believe. So I don't know if I would understand right now if I just looked how set up without digging a little bit more. But I think he said there were some pros and cons to that versus what he had before. But that's just something I need to explore. And I think it's something that he's interested in standardize on and giving add-on developers a standard way to do this.
That would be awesome. I mean, yes. The reality of, I think you work with add-ons where you need this, so you're willing to go through that pain. But the stuff that I've mainly been working on, it's like,
is it worth it?
I'm on the margin,
right?
And I don't want to go through that. So that's the way to get that into my add-ons.
Right. If it was as easy as a generator or something, yep, just to give you that sandbox.
Cool. I mean, maybe with this like realization that I can't actually test against a brand new Octane app, maybe that will actually push me over the margin. And
yeah, we can just knock that out together. But it seems more of a pain than it is. I can get it set up in like 5 minutes just by copy pasting from Mirage or Storefront.
5 minutes
or a Tailwind or something.
5 minutes.
Yeah, it's really easy.
Okay, let's go.
You right literally now. Just new up an app, and then you go to your package JSON, because you don't want the test app's package JSON to have its own versions of things. You want it to get it from the host. So you just do star, and then you copy this Linkum script. And what you end up doing, you have test app / scenario 1 / basic app, and it gets a symlink to the root node modules folder.
All of its packages resolve because they're all star.
Yeah.
So it can work with basically anything in your root app to find some.
Yeah. And when all the lookups start happening, it just is symlinking to the root. So other than that, it's literally a brand new Ember app or add-on.
Yeah, that's appealing. I mean, that's really appealing.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, not a lot of abstraction there.
Cool, we good with test apps?
Yeah, good with test apps, yep.
So the next item, as I was doing all this testing, upgrading work, was...
you working on Storefront?
Storefront and some fast boot testing stuff. And it's actually, you kind of hit on this during that last piece, but I am used to writing in the 3.0 style of Ember now, so I don't use .get, this dot whatever dot first object when I'm working with an array. It's awesome,
right?
Angle brackets,
right?
You know, all this good stuff,
right?
So I wrote a bunch of tests and add-on code in this style and pushed it. And Travis failed on 218.
Oh.
And it was, the failures were like, cannot read property first object of computed property descriptor, stuff right. like that. It like wasn't obvious.
Right.
And I kind of like went through my tests and then I was able to figure out like, you know, I ran the try scenario locally and I was able to figure out, it's like, oh yeah, like you're writing
using three syntax APIs that,
that didn't exist in 218.
Yeah.
So I think like, the fix here is obvious, like just use .get and use the old, so write your add-on code as if it supports the oldest version of Ember. But then I guess my question here is like, there's a trade-off. You're trading off like ergonomics for backwards compatibility. And like, when do you make the decision to drop an old version of Ember to get advantage of these new ergonomics?
Good question. I think there's, we need to ask some folks about this, but I think there's might be two parts of this. One is, do your tests need to work in old versions? And then the second is, does your add-on need to work in older versions? Because even though both your add-on is, your tests are running your add-on code in old versions of Ember.
Both. I mean, I can answer both.
But no, I know that both is what we're interested in, but I thought there was a way to do new style stuff and like Babel takes care of it and all that stuff takes care of it from the add-on land.
So like the new testing syntax where it's like you import everything from Ember test helpers, like that is all backwards compatible. Works in,
but the this.get.
Yeah.
So like you're this.get through from add-on code or from test code?
It was test code. I was running an assertion in test code.
Yeah.
But I also had add-on code using it too.
And that blew up?
Yeah. Everything blew up.
It did.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Cause I'm, you're in 218, like this dot first object is like a computed property.
Yeah.
Where this dot first object in 3x is like the result of that computed property.
Right. Getter. I feel like there's a way to do this though. I feel like there's a way to polyfill to something that there's some way to make it so that you can author more modern versions of Ember code, even though you support older versions.
Okay. So an example of this I know is like angle brackets do have a polyfill that will right. angle bracket, you know, all the way to like 216, right?
Right. Maybe that's just the answer. Is just every new feature you use, you have to polyfill it.
You have to polyfill it.
In dev dependencies so that your test can run, not right. in dependencies.
Right, right. I don't know. Yeah, I guess we need to ask.
I guess I don't know, though, because then if you have an angle bracket in your components template, maybe you do have to depend on, you have to have angle bracket polyfill as a dependency so that if my old app installs your collapsible panel that's written with angle brackets, I'm also getting the polyfill for sure. That's probably actually...
Okay, so then the question there, again,
this goes... I think Ember Animated has a dependency on the polyfill for that very reason, so that he can use angle brackets within his source code.
Interesting. Okay, so then this, I guess there's, maybe the trade-off is like minimal, but there is a trade-off of
adding dependent, like polyfills.
Right, adding the polyfill versus,
Yeah, and what if the host tools. App is like in 3.8 and doesn't want your polyfill? But maybe polyfills are inert in 3.8. Actually, I think polyfills get like, which would be, that's pretty cool.
They're just, they leave the room. They show themselves
so.
To the door.
I think so. I think they get compiled out. They get treed out by broccoli. They're like, nice. You know.
Yeah, it's just, I think if you look at like the Ember releases page, I don't think 2.16 is supported anymore. But we've talked on this podcast about like, backwards compatibility is like a badge
yes.
of honor.
Yes.
So I don't just, even though 2.16 isn't supported, I'm not going to drop that right. for my Ember try.
Right, right, right.
But now...
There's a trade-off.
Yeah, now I'm wondering...
Before, like, you didn't think that there was, you were facing a trade-off, but now, right.
Yeah. So, you know, I just updated everything to use old syntax.
I mean, this is definitely even, like, what about, like, Glimmer components? Are those polyfillable? Like... There's a lot of new APIs coming.
Yeah, you know? I guess as more new APIs come out, this
if they're polyfillable, then that's the answer. Like yep. you can use them in an add-on if they are, but if not, then not. So we should be able to get the answer to that though if we ask some folks in yeah. Discord.
Yep.
Yeah, Octane has a lot of new stuff coming. I mean, apps are gonna look different in a year from now. I think they're gonna look real different. A lot of our code's gonna look very different. I did that video last week on. Something. What did I do it on?
Angle brackets.
Yeah, it was just on angle bracket. What was the component? Oh yeah, like the button and and the grid. And when I was doing it for the button, you know, angle brackets, you can just change at the invocation site. You can just change it from curlies to angles, and then JavaScript arguments prefix them with an app, and that's all you do, and everything will work the same. But because you get splat attributes, you actually kind of want to change how you write the code. I mentioned this in the video. And so originally I started going down that path of refactoring the button, but it's like there's a lot of work there, even for a button. I mean, there's just, yeah, it's just, yeah. It's good. It's good work. It's all like removing crappy APIs like attribute bindings. But it's going to look a lot different. It's going to look way better. I can't wait to do it. But yeah, it's like a good amount of work.
Nice.
It's like a new mental, it's like the apps are going to look different.
You got,
I'm excited.
You got, the button stuff all merged in Ember Map, right?
Like yeah.
Every button is using the angle bracket.
Yeah, there's button. No more UI button. There's no more UI grid.
Very cool.
There's just button and grid. Yeah, it looks awesome.
Nice.
It looks awesome. Yeah, I was kind of nervous about that, actually. I think there's a code mod. I wanted to go back and mention that, but I think there's a code mod for doing this, but I don't think it's actually truly code moddable to a point of being provably correct because you don't know whether something's an attribute or an argument, I think. But there's basically a way that it's going to do most of the work for you. In any case, I just changed it manually in Ember Maps code base and then ran the test and everything and got rid of UI button and pushed it. But I was definitely like a little, I felt good because our test passed, but you know, there could be a button somewhere and I could have, the tests don't stress every single part of it. Some yep. attribute, you know, some style, href. Also, we have like some, this is another thing that's like, man, the at sign, having the at sign as arguments versus not having it for attributes is really great. It's really great. This is another reason why I wanted to redo the buttons API, because in current Ember, you don't have that differentiation. So we have like a UI button, curly curly UI button, and we have like href equals, and we have like style equals link. That's what we do because we have like a style argument. And maybe you could argue that this is like not the best API, but this is just what we came up with. And I think a lot of people are probably in this boat where they're not actually thinking about, yeah, there's no reason to think about style being a JavaScript argument versus an HTML attribute and it being confusing because you're just like, oh, this is a component invocation. I'm passing a JavaScript here. So we have this UI button style
that,
equals.
Wait, that's the API.
Yeah,
like 100%. You don't need to think about that.
Yeah.
Well, now you do. Yeah. But back then, you didn't need to.
Exactly. So we have this UI button style equals blue large link. Side note, I still need to take some time to figure out like the best way. How the heck do you render a freaking link that looks like a button or a button that looks like a link and share those styles?
Every time I try to do a button that looks like a link, I end up switching and doing a link that looks like a button because it's just so much easier.
But like, you shouldn't render a link if it doesn't change the URL.
I know. But it's so, you get like this weird gray outline.
Yeah,
the,
I know.
The vertical alignment is just slightly off.
We just got to look and see how folks are doing it in either other communities or, yeah. We'll get there.
It would be awesome.
I want to land on something. Like right.
An add-on that just
did it.
Yeah.
So we have this style thing, right? And it's like, so you do like UI button and like style equals link. And then, so if you want to render a link that looks like a button, whenever the last time we worked on this, we just said like, okay, if you're looking at this, this is like a UI button. If the UI button is a presenter, then you're looking at a button. So you render a button. That's kind of where we ended up on it, right? So what you do is you pass in style link and then you give it an href because you want all links to have hrefs so you can command click them in an SPA, which is something that's easy to forget. So now you switch it from so it's curly UI button style equals blue link, let's say, or something primary link or whatever brand link. So it's running a button, it's brought primary color and it's style link. So we have our style mixin changes the button to an actual A tag. This is how we reuse the styles because they're all on button because you're always rendering what looks like a button, but you change it to an A tag and you also assert that it has an href because it needs to have an href. And so then you pass in an href and then you get to use like href2 to calculate it, which is great. It's awesome. So if you just look at this thing, curly UI button, style equals blue brand link, and then href equals href2 videos series.first video. Then you change it to an angle bracket. So now it's an angle bracket, and then you have at style and at href, and then you have like class. What if you have href? Like, what if you add style to it? It's like, it's super confusing. It becomes like, you're like, wait, I would never have done this if I was doing this before because the at sign makes it so clear what's a JavaScript argument and what is an HTML attribute. And so you're like, I want people who are using my components to build on top of their HTML knowledge.
Yes.
And if they want to render a link of mine and give it an href, they should be able to do that with just href and curly.
At href is, you see that, and it's like total violation of expectations.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know what I really wish is that Ember, the way you would link, was always href in the template, and you would just always set href. And that does the string thing, but there's also a global thing that intercepts a click so that it doesn't do a full page refresh, right?
Yep.
I think that's kind of what like href2 does.
Yes, that's exactly what href2 does.
So that's pretty sweet because if you think about that, I think you can just, correct me if I'm wrong, you can just render an anchor tag, href equals curly href2, right? And it would work?
Yes.
So then it's so cool because let's just say you have an A tag that's HTML, and you do href equals. It's a plain HTML attribute, and you do curly href2. You switch the lowercase a to a capital link. That's a component, but you don't have to change the href, and the curly is still around the href.
Because you're still saying this thing under the hood. It takes an href.
You can do whatever you want with that attribute. Thing. You're going to do the right thing. You're going to render, your link component is going to render an A somewhere, and it's going to pass that along. It's going to attributes on that thing.
Okay, so it's passing along with like splat attributes
exactly.
or whatever. Or just use it directly.
Or just using directly.
Yeah, okay.
Yep. So awesome, though.
Yes.
It's so awesome that it's just such a better leap, such a better step, such a better abstraction than going to like, yeah, curly, and now you're passing a JavaScript argument that's an href. How does this get serialized? How does it get represented in the server? Like, it's just so clear. So anyways, I feel like there's a lot of this kind of thing that doesn't become apparent until you kind of try it out and kick the tires with it. And then you're like, oh man, this is so much clearer. And it's going to let me change a lot of this kind of code that was like really kind of not the best Yeah. And you always, we always kind of felt like there were some of those UI components that like could you, yeah, we want to name blocks, we want splash attributes, we could be, make them so much better. Now we kind of have some of those things.
I mean, UI button is a perfect example that it's a, always a button from the user point of view, but depending on where it is, sometimes it's an actual button, sometimes it's an input, sometimes it's a yes. A tag.
Yes.
So it was always one of the like, and that implementation leaks.
Right. So, yes, exactly.
So it was, you had to know this. Yeah. Interesting.
So I really, really like angle brackets. Yeah. It's also just like when you do curly, curly UI button, href equals S expression, like sub expression, href two, close sub expression. Mm-hmm. But now your link is an angle. So the href two gets its own curlies. So that's what another part I didn't understand that I didn't understand it at a visceral level that when you're going to change it, things that were sub expressions, since you're already within a curly, curly invocation, become themselves curlies. You go up one level because the outer level is no longer curlies, which is great because it's just that much clearer. Like this is a function running. This is a component invocation. It's separate. It's really awesome. Yeah. It's really awesome.
Nice.
It's really awesome. And yeah, for those, any listeners who haven't either seen the video or saw the update to the polyfill, angle brackets can be used with nested components now in subdirectories, which is why we made the video last week, because there's no more reason not to use it in an app. That was like the last big thing. So it's pretty sweet. It's nice. Pretty sweet. Next step would be like Glimmer components and like no more did insert element, using modifiers on every element you care about, changing all that stuff. So it's going to be a lot. We're going to have a lot of stuff to teach over the next year for sure.
Nice.
So yeah, pretty cool. What else you got for me?
So this is similar to that, what you just talked about. I think some other stuff that you, like I saw on your Twitter this week, but last week I ran into something where, okay, there's something I like about HTML and that HTML is the same in every single app that I work on. Like the API for an A tag, I know what it's got an href, it's got a class, it takes a block. I close the A tag.
Yep.
It's just the same in every single app. So when I jump around from all these different apps, I know like, oh, this should be a table. Here's how that HTML is going to look. I've noticed with like the domain components. Were we talking about this? No, because I didn't.
I was thinking about this in some other context. Okay, keep going.
So I noticed with like the domain components and then even more so with the UI components, they're generally the same in every app, but their APIs differ. And I find this really hard when, you know, I'm working on a new app every 8 weeks. So like the button tag, the capital B button tag, the button component.
Yeah.
That API could differ. It could differ as simple as like one has like an on click and the other has an on dash click.
Yeah.
But it could differ in other ways of like one passes in like a
task and one takes an action or something.
Yeah. Or like one has like an is running and the other takes like state or just, they're just, and it makes sense that these differ because these buttons were written for two different apps. Right. So it's not fair to say like, oh, these two buttons should be exactly the same. It's like, no, these buttons were written for two different apps. They have different constraints and requirements. But it's just one of those things I notice that like my HTML knowledge is portable.
Mm-hmm.
But my component knowledge
feels like semi-portable.
Yeah. And a lot of these apps we work on and we help set up the best practices. So mm-hmm. It's like they're coming from our UI components, mm-hmm. but they're still, they drift and mm-hmm. there's different use cases. Mm-hmm. And it's mm-hmm. just, yeah, it's hard. It's hard. I have to like go open up the component, see what the options are.
Mm-hmm.
It does not feel like writing HTML. So yeah, I just like, how do we improve that? Yeah. Like do runtime exceptions, compile time exceptions, like how do we improve that? How do we make the, that capital B button component feel more natural?
That's a really interesting question. The first thing that struck me while you were saying that was when thinking back to how Adam talked about when he first made Tailwind, and originally it was going to be much more like a bootstrap kind of thing that comes with like a panel and a collapsible drop-down list and all that kind of stuff. And he realized the only things that he was copying from one project to the next were the utilities, which is why he went all in on the utilities. But so that's one thing, which is like, what are you copying from project to project? And like, maybe there's an abstraction there that's not the whole button, but it's the aspects of the button that are the same. And if there's a good way to abstract that, what would it look like? Now, I wouldn't go ahead and jump into something that's like an inner button and an outer, but whatever it's going to be, it's going to be awful the first time. But I also wouldn't say like, oh, HTML button is the lowest level thing. That's the only reusable thing, because what you're saying is like, you always have an on click, you always have a style way to vary it. And so you could imagine something higher level existing. I'm just not exactly sure what it would look like. I think the renderless stuff is a great way. I think if I was going to start today with trying to make like, if I was in a situation like we were at TED and we had a bunch of apps and we had components that were being shared, but sometimes looked different and had extra stuff, the renderless approach is really good. And, you know, we were just talking about this with Elon, this guy who kind of took over maintenance of Ember Collapsible Panel, because that was an add-on that we that originated from our work there. And he wanted to take over that because he's still using it. And we were talking about, you know, originally we had some plans to work on it some more, and how would that library look today if we were to make a collapsible panel shareable add-on today. We ended up saying no to it because we wanted to protect our time and focus on other things. And we realized we couldn't kind of give 100% to it. So he took it over. And but if we were going to work on it, it would look much more like a renderless component today. So I think there's some things like this that are like, it's not always obvious which aspects are shareable.
Yep.
But in the renderless component case, in the collapsible panel case, like what are you doing every time? You have a trigger that toggles it. You have something that expands or collapses. And that's the stuff that you want to wrap up and pre-wire in the contextual component. Everything else, the styling, even the tags you use, you want the caller to customize. And we hit this with our dropdown menu series, where we make it fully renderless at the end, and we use like view bounds that says like whatever the thing you pass in here is like the toggle, whatever the thing here is like the nested menu. And so I think the renderless component is like really good.
Interesting. So I mean, it's almost what you're getting at is like find the shareable stuff, extract it.
Yeah.
And that extraction is going to look renderless.
Yeah, I think so.
Because
you can imagine like button having an async state that it yields, and just having it always be the same thing. But what it does, whether it makes it bigger and adds a loading spinner, whether it changes the text to saving, that's the stuff that changes. But the fact that a button is like async, you know, and again, we had like async button like 5 years ago. It was like a Dockyard add-on when Ember first came out. And it's like, oh, this is true. We do have an async button in every single app. Mm-hmm. But then it's like, you're like, you don't, no good way to extend it, or it starts by rendering a button with a class, and then you have to like add or remove classes to cut. And it's like the renderless stuff is better way to do that. So
cool.
I think that might be what the next wave of like shareable base primitives look like, you know?
Cool. I was also thinking like, I want like autocomplete in my templates
to always be the same.
Yeah. I just want like,
you don't have to, if you don't have to start from scratch, if you were to need that in a new app.
Well, I was just thinking, like, if I'm, I just, whatever apps button I'm rendering, it probably has a click thing. It might be on click, on dash click, mm-hmm. It might just be click. I don't know. I just want to type click, let my editor just autocomplete.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this thing has a.
You're saying was it IntelliSense in your templates?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know what the actual, like, implementation thing is. It's right. Just something that's like. Yeah, again, it's like
when you're saying it's a bad abstraction if you have to go open it up and look at what the API is.
Yeah, and it makes sense. It's just, why is it different between every app? Well, it's just that's what happened when the apps were written.
Yeah.
Some of these apps were written like 5 years apart. There's not like...
Right. There's no reason why they would necessarily end up being the same thing. Yeah, the IntelliSense stuff is interesting, and the template being aware of types, basically, is interesting too. That was one thing that I was... talked about this week with some folks. Was we talked about it in the video series that's going on right now, because I'm actually working on a feature in Ember Map, and you have this component. This is what happens sometimes, and I explain it in the video, but I can just recap right here. What happens is, and this happened to us in a consulting project last year, where you do your data fetching in the route, you render a component. And a component expects like the user, current user to have been loaded, and also like the current series with all of its videos. And then you start breaking that component up into other components, but they're still like, you're just breaking it up to keep it easier to work with, but the route is still handling the data fetching. Then it comes a time where like, oh, it'd be really nice to reuse this component at somewhere else. So you do that and you're like, oh wait, it actually implicitly relies on all this data fetching. So right there, I feel like there's a thing here that we need to do, which is that we make components for two reasons. One of them is to be able to reuse them, and the other one is to break up a large component or template into smaller components. And those are different things, because if you're using these to do, like, if you're just breaking things up into smaller components to do structural components, like, this is the header, this is the body, this is the footer, and those, like, could all be in one template, but I'm going to make them in three different components and call a header and a footer and a body because it's going to be easy. The problem with that is that there's implicit, they know about their environment. There's implicit dependencies that they have in their environment that's not declared anywhere. Versus a button that's like, it's a reusable button. It's a dumb thing. It expects this interface. It's like the prop type stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think there's a problem here. Even if we had something like prop types and we were using it all the time, there's a problem because the flow that a developer is in when they're on this refactoring path, there's not a clear distinction when it's like, first you were just taking a big template and cutting it up into five small components. 6 months later, you want to render the video list of all the videos on another page. So you know, you see, oh, can we put this thing here? Sure. You grab it, you render it. All of a sudden, it renders in a broken state because it has half of its data, because it had an implicit dependency on the data that was provided to it by its context, by its ancestor. And it didn't say that anywhere. So this is something we ran into in the series and just talked about different ways we could solve it. One way we talked about solving this in the past, or we have this assert must preload thing in Storefront, which is like, this template needs this current series provided to it. It's like a typed argument. But even if you had types, like, you could imagine that not being enough, right? Because if you had a type thing that said, like, this takes a series and it doesn't work without it, you could pass me a series that has half the videos loaded. It's going to be wrong.
Yeah.
So that's a problem. So you really want something like what we did just kind of as an experiment is like assert must preload. So, like, you assert that this thing must be preloaded with the full video series. Or you could assert, like, we've talked about this before, like, you could assert some query was already made, or really like some subset of your data graph has been loaded, and that's what it depends on. And ideally there's a declarative way to do that such that the tooling can piece together all of the subgraphs needed for every component being rendered and do it for you. And like, that would be pretty awesome.
Yeah, this, I mean, my, correct me if I'm wrong, this feels like not like a typing problem. It feels more like a runtime. This feels like errors that happen at runtime. Like if I have an explicit implicit expectation that there'll be a current user,
right,
and this thing has access to the current user, but at runtime that's null,
right?
That seems
a problem.
Yeah,
you could potentially say that you could potentially do something at compile time if you, let's just say, just thinking out loud here, stay with me, let's say the component had a query that it provided. We were talking about this when we were talking about this, like, maybe in the component folder itself you have like video lists, it has like a template.js, template.hbs, component.js, and has like a query.graphql or something. Yeah, query.js, whatever. You could ensure that an ancestor of that component invoked that query, that it was imported and invoked somewhere at compile time. Somehow, let's say. No?
It's like, base case, yes, but then like, it's a halting problem, right? Like,
Why does it? Ed told me I was doing this too. Ed told me that there was something that I was doing that.
It's like,
I always get to this point.
If you, it's like, you can only tell these things at runtime because if you.
But I'm looking at your code and I'm seeing that you never.
Okay, so
ran this function.
So I say, this is like the halting problem. It's like, if Sam is looking at
la,
my.
La 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 la. I don't want to hear it.
If Sam is looking at my code, run the function, else. Don't run the function. That's like the whole idea behind
it. Oh, that's pretty good. That made me understand.
That's how Turing saw this. He's like, we can take a program and pass it to the program that tells if it's running it, and if it's going through itself, it knows. I'm butchering this.
Yeah, I think I get the idea. I think I get the gist of it. Is this related to like the set of all sets that contain itself?
That was Russell's explanation.
Paradox or whatever.
Yeah.
So that means like the foundations of math are still shaky, right?
Isn't
that what the result of all that was?
No, but I think you said, I was like, we can't trust math. None of this, the
yeah.
It's what is Russell's paradox? Does it have a
Bertrand
name?
Russell's.
Yeah. Is it just,
Yeah, Russell.
Set of all sets does not contain itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Or Russell. does a set of all sets contain it?
You cannot define it within Cantor set theory, I believe. Does a set of all sets that do not contain themselves.
It's if you have a set of sets that do not contain themselves, is that set in it?
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah. And if it's in it, then it's not in it. If it's not in it, then it is in it. Yeah.
Butchering math. I remember I was complaining that we can't trust math one day. And you were like, well, we can build bridges and walk over them. And I was like, okay, that makes me feel a little better.
Yeah. That just means, yeah. It is true that there's some aspects of math that we can't trust because of that. But there's, yeah, we're building bridges. Anyways, okay, whatever. Compile time versus runtime doesn't matter. Let's just start with runtime. It's way easier. A component provides a query that must be invoked. And so there's some state somewhere in your application, your program, that's that when the component is invoked and invocated, it asserts that the query has been run.
Yes.
And you could do that at the level, at a very granular level, if you had a tool like Storefront that could take multiple queries running within a single tick of a loop or whatever and coalesce them and then use caching and avoid extra stuff. So you could do that.
Yeah. And I think that would be good, like, just think of, like, how I actually develop apps. I would get some, like, error thrown because I didn't run this query. My test would fail, or I would just see, like, the page not render if I'm actively developing it.
Right.
And that would be enough. Like, that would be good enough for me to,
right, to get. Now, I wonder if you could do this in a way that's, like, not, you're not going to hate your life, where, like, you start with a template, and then you like grab this part of the header and you just like, I just want to throw it in a header component. So like I grab it, make a new header, throw it there, boom. And then it's like you get an error because it's like your header is trying to render current user and hasn't declared your dependencies. So you're like, I hate myself. But then you're like, but maybe you just, there's an easy way to go and you throw a query property on there and you just say, yeah, something, some very nice expressive way that says, maybe you couldn't even infer it from the template. If the template is doing current session dot something, then like if I ever use current session dot current user dot is admin, there's some other part of the thing that's telling me like that code has an implicit dependency that current session dot fetch has ever been run. Yeah. Something like that.
Or like current session, which is a service, could define it's like I don't work unless some data has been loaded.
Right.
And you therefore if I'm injecting it, my component also gets those right. data requirements.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, this is funny because it's like you think about the async relationship stuff and you're like render post.comments. And it's like there's something similar about that where it's like Ember Data already knows enough about the data dependencies to try to get your back if you render it and it doesn't have it. We just would rather see it throw an error.
Yeah.
To force you to hoist the data loading, to force you to remember, to acknowledge that you haven't thought about how the data is going to get there yet so you can take care of it. So it's effectively actually very similar to that. And now in that case is easy. We could talk about like this for 3 hours. Post.comments, you can say if you've never loaded it, right? And so right. you could throw an error. You're trying to access post.comments. And not that it's zero comments, it's that you've never loaded it. So you've definitely made a mistake. The harder point is the queries that are more complex than that. So you're viewing series, building a video player, it has 10 videos, and I'm going to check if you have the current user has a video played event, has finished this, a video view for one of these 10 videos. That's a subset of all the video views for the user, and so how would you couldn't just say from the template alone. Maybe there's some way you could, but maybe in those situations you need to do a little bit more work to declare your data dependencies. Because it's a problem. It's a problem that the path to refactoring and cleaning things up involves breaking up large components into small components that have implicit dependencies that are giving you an affordance that you can reuse them because components are reusable. But you've made a component not reusable by design. You've designed it to work within a specific context
within a specific route
that has implicit dependencies on the data being fetched by that route. And so now, but there's all these affordances that are saying, oh yeah, just reuse the video list elsewhere. It's so easy. Look how you do it. I mean, it's a component and components are meant to be reused except that when they're not, you know? So you reuse it and then you get screwed. And this has happened to us a bunch, and we've seen it happen to a lot of people. It's a big problem.
Okay, but isn't like,
because then you go and you, oh right, for this to work, what do you do next? Your thing doesn't work and you're like, oh right, I need the video views. So I go up to the route and I start adding all this data loading stuff to the route.
And then it's like, you're just, why is this here?
Yeah.
But isn't like the I want you to expand on this, but isn't the obvious answer here, oh, just put the data loading inside the component because the component needs the data to load.
Yeah, but then you get to the thing which we got to in the series, which we talked about, which is sometimes you want the data loading to be done at the route level because you want the route to be a choke point for an initial meaningful render of that particular page.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't. So sometimes you want the component to lazily fetch its own data. Sometimes you want it to hoist its data loading to its ancestor. But in the event that you want a component to do that, you still want the option. You still want to have some feedback. That's not. Yeah, you want some feedback.
You know, when we were talking about this last week, I did bring up suspense.
Yeah.
And it does. I think it's really nice here because you can move that choke point up in your component hierarchy anywhere. And then if a route doesn't have the data it needs, it throws an exception. And the thing that catches it is it doesn't even throw it. Implementation-wise, it throws an exception, right. But it blocks. It blocks.
Yeah.
But the thing that actually decides where to block is up in your tree. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
So you can move that choke point all the way to the root. You can move that choke point to the direct parent.
One spinner, they were saying, is solving like one spinner for them, basically. That's pretty interesting.
So, and this is a whole, like, they're designing it like try-catch. There's some fancy CS words, algebraic effects or something.
Right.
But the whole idea is you can throw... and something above you can catch. You don't know where above it is.
Yeah.
Just like a try catch block works.
Yep. That's pretty interesting.
So yeah, when you're talking about choke point, I'm just imagining like an actual choke point component that you just move up and down and you decide where it is. And then it just knows, hey, I block if none of my components have loaded their data.
Okay. So just two final thoughts as we close this up. Is my phone over there? Cause I have a tweet I want to look up. First thought is, that sounds pretty awesome. One aspect of this that's problematic or that I see just that I want to understand addressed is like what I'm talking about is you break up this component, big component into three small ones. And like the second one has this implicit dependency on the data being fetched in the route and then you reuse it. If you had something like that choke point component or suspense, it would work if the component fetched its data. But part of the problem here is that it doesn't. So what is the path? Yes. What's the API path for turning something and adding those dependencies somehow? And it could be like we see post.comments is in your template. So therefore you have a dependency on post.comments and now we know you haven't loaded it. So we can tell you something about that. But there's a lot of times where that's not true. Mm-hmm. That's something that still needs to be addressed.
Right. And as Ember developers, we would want to see that addressed in like a conventional way where it's like components have like a data fetching hook or whatever.
Exactly.
But that would
need a model hook.
Yes. A model hook. But that would need to be addressed.
That would need to be addressed. The second thing is that I tweeted about this, about basically wanting some conventional way to specify this model hook for components that could declare your data needs in a way that is idempotent so that it respects caching the same way we like to architect our model hooks in our routes. So that it can be called many times. And if the component's being reused, the tooling could just call it again, right?
Mm-hmm. Render from cache type thing. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, just that if you had a model hook on your components and you return, you know, storefront.findPost1 and you're now on a new page and you're rendering five different components and all their model hooks are that, it doesn't matter.
Yep.
They're declaring their data needs. The tooling is taken care of using the cache when appropriate, making a new network request when appropriate, right? So that's like the ideal, right? At least in my mind, it was. Seems like it. Seems like components that have data dependencies, those should be declared and explicit, such that if you could snap your fingers, a tool would be able to stitch those together in an efficient way, and that way you'd also get feedback if you were using them in an environment where the ancestor didn't do the data fetching.
Yeah. Feel like you're about to drop some knowledge on me right now.
Well, not some knowledge, just that Ed said that that's a bad idea.
Why?
I don't know. That's what we got to figure out. That's going to be the cliffhanger for this episode. So let me find this tweet because he just dropped this right on me and ruined my day. because I was like, man, I've got this great idea. You know, I'm just patting myself on the back. And how do I search Twitter? Like, from Ed to Sam? Can I do that? From, what does EAF4 mean anyways? EAF4. That was a great episode, by the way, that interview.
Last week's.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got a lot of interesting stuff to say. So I basically was tweeting about this, right? And I said I basically want to move all data fetching to components and templates, and at the invocation site specify whether a component's data fetching function should block the router or not.
No, but you can't. No. That doesn't. No, because the router won't render its template until it's unblocked.
So I think that's what he was talking about. It's the halting problem again. You have to render it in order to know what to render, kind of thing. I'm talking about something simpler, which is just like literally, if you had a model function on a component, like what we were talking about, and you said like block router true, then the route could just, in its model hook, do a container lookup for the components that are in the template. Oh, I guess which components are being rendered.
Yeah. You have to unblock the router to render the template to know what components are rendered, and you can't then,
because you have an if.
You can't then reblock the router. So, I mean, you could imagine like there's a.
I see why it's a problem now. That part of it. You could still have a conventional way to share a data loading function.
You need a way to render components that aren't. It's like a pre-render. This component will most likely be entering.
Do one pass. Yeah. But it's also. So that's part of the thing that's like. That's what makes it impossible to know at build time what data fetching you need. I get that, I think. There's this other part, which is like the relay model or the Falcor model, or I guess a suspense model or something, where you actually render them. You render them once, they render, and then they send back what their data query that they need is, and then you go ahead and block. Well, not block, but you've rendered them, but you're just showing us, you're showing the loading template while you do that or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, in response, he said, I think you should implement this. Because one, it's not that hard to build on top of the primitives we have. Two, some people would definitely find it useful. Three, you will uncover the pitfalls that make it not really desirable as apps and teams grow bigger.
Interesting.
So I don't know if his evaluation of that pattern would apply to suspense, would apply to relay, which aspects of those he likes or doesn't like, and how it might apply to a solution like this. But it's kind of interesting to me. Anyways.
Yes, that's really good too, because I would like to push the runtime.
Yeah.
Like a cert must preload type stuff.
Yes.
Further.
Yes.
In getting that feedback.
Yeah.
Yep. Cool.
So maybe we'll chat with him and talk more about what we find out next week.
Yeah. I will say it's really easy to say, oh, components should just load data and all data loading should be done in components. But man, the router, always come back to this. The router just provides from like just a mental model of how web pages work, load data, then render,
right,
to just like all the battle tested APIs and guarantees. It's like, I do not want to give that up.
Oh, absolutely not. And again, I was like pairing with Adam on a Vue app, and they were doing the same thing. It's like, it's a product decision. You want to make it. It's, you want this, the tooling to have you, you know, how do I do this? Block the transition and then render when the data changes, when the URL changes, all that stuff. You want that. In the video series, what I end up doing is like, I have this video list component and I export a named function. So default export is a component just like normal. And then I export a named function called load data. And then in the one context where it lazily renders, I import that into the parent component, render it using an Ember concurrency task, load it using an Ember concurrency task, and then render it once I have the data. And the other context where I use this component, I import the load data function in the route and then return it from the route's model hook alongside other data that the route is loading, and then render it as a dumb presenter, but the route is responsible. So I really like this because, again, I like the fact that I can do it, not necessarily the API. It's just like something I made up, but you could imagine the API being standardized in some way. You basically have, it's what we're talking about. You have a component. It has dependencies on data. Now they're explicit. You open the route file and you see a load data method is being imported from the video list components and you're rendering a video. So, why am I calling this method? Probably because I'm rendering a video list.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
No, totally.
It's really good.
It's weird. It's weird that like there's component code that's running outside of the lifecycle of the component, but it's also, there's something, why are you loading data?
Right.
To render this component.
Yeah, exactly.
And so there's something that's really, really appealing about that.
And it's not even on the component anymore. It's just literally a pure function that I export from the same file.
Right.
But yes,
it's component code because it's in component.js. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
And that's kind of
exactly
why I like a query.js.
Yeah.
Yep. Query.graphql yep. in my component.
Because then you're like, maybe you author the query knowing it could be used anywhere.
Yeah. It's also kind of like if you think of like style.css, that's included everywhere. I guess that does kind of get wrapped up in its own namespace, but you know, it's okay.
Yep. Interesting stuff.
Yeah.
I think there's something here. I think a year from now we'll be doing something like this standardized since we keep copying and pasting this kind of thing across our apps.
And the fact that you just started doing this and importing a query, I think is going to be like... First one is always the most difficult, right?
Right.
So then we'll just keep doing it and doing it. And
yep.
Nice.
Cool.
Let's wrap it.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us. If you have any questions, anything you want to talk about on the podcast, let us know. Ratings and reviews, super appreciated. We have like 9 5-star reviews on iTunes. It's awesome.
Nice.
It's cool.
The 10th person gets $1 million.
What would a 10th person get? I have like lots of conference t-shirts. Maybe I'll just start sending out my old used coffee.
Like a used.
Like that. I actually usually just wear them to the gym.
With like pit stains.
Pit stains, yellow collars, you know.
They just get like a little hard under there.
If anyone wants my used conference t-shirts and you review us on iTunes, I will mail them to you. Wait, is my yes my yes?
What if there's just all of a sudden there's like 25 star reviews? Hey, Sam.
We should make a t-shirt sometime. Anyways, it's hot in here, isn't it? I think I'm getting delusional. I think it's time to end the podcast.
All right, go rate us on iTunes. Yes. 5 stars. It helps get the word out.
Definitely. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week.